Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. Yesterday, we talked about some interesting concepts on impeachment, and we also talked about the interesting concept that possibly presidents can be impeached, even though, and I'll get into it right now. Presidents and congressmen, because they have lifelong emoluments, because when the Constitution was written, they didn't have retirement plans and continued involvement, especially past presidents. Past presidents is a permanent position. You will get security for the rest of your life. You will get intelligence briefings. You will be, you know, advised and or even consulted regarding issues. And so they created a permanency of emoluments once you became president of the United States. Even Nixon was an emolument receiver because he did not have the removal of all of his benefits. He still had security. He still had those things. And because of that, that means he is an employee. He is still a public servant and can be impeached. The full impeachment is not just a removal from office, but you are stripped of all entitlements from the federal government. You'd receive no more emoluments. And that's what they were clearly defining, that the emoluments were removed from you, that you could never receive emoluments, profit, or anything else. Do you understand now? So past presidents can, because they are receiving profits, they can be impeached, not just because they were in office at one point in time. They are still on the, you know, on the docks. They are still not necessarily public servants elected, but they've received a permanency as a past president. And the only way we can actually go after them is not just in a criminal case. We can actually strip them of all their emoluments and profits. And impeachment is the process of doing that without convicting them. Clearly, as I made the case, clearly President Clinton has violated acts against the United States and has been treasonous, all so that he could get money from China so that he could get reelected. With that, I want you to understand moving forward that we're going to get into some ratification debates that actually helps paint this picture, I think, a little clearer, because of why we do impeachments, because of the harm that has been caused. But I am leaning too much into what we're going to do without telling you. Welcome back. You are listening to the only show that gives you the academic evidence and the evidence-based solutions. The question I've been asking, are you a part of the problem? You are a part of the problem unless you are a part of the solution. If you're having problems at work, if you're having problems in your marriage, problems at home, problems on your team, problems in the band, you're a part of the problem unless you're a part of the solution. You know, constantly bickering, constantly being divisive, constantly doing these things is a part of the problem. When you start uniting in solving the problem, that means you are now a part of the solution. Okay? So we also have a listener drive. We'd like to encourage you to actually get listeners to come on board, listen to what we're talking about, and understanding the Constitution. I will say this is a beautiful thing that we're offering, because you cannot find audiobooks that actually read the ratification debates. Now, I don't read the whole thing, but I am reading actual citations out of these things. And if you want to actually see this text, go to mobiusstrippress.com and look on the left-hand side for links to the ratification debate extracts on the militia, or just ratification debate extracts. And that's where you'll find a bevy of good information regarding the ratifications and how they defined the Constitution and how we've been lied to in telling us that they could do all of these things that they've been doing to us, which we now realize are unconstitutional. Don't forget, we want you to start planting seeds in your community to getting them on board with supporting the Constitution and making it more relevant to life. I mean, we need to start creating more focus on the Constitution. I know you may be jonesing for the news. Those news cycles are never ending, and they're going to constantly get you distracted. And if you're not on the problem in solving it, then you're just allowing the problem to perpetuate. There's going to be more and more kids killed in schools. There's going to be more gun violence. These things are going to continue until we work together in solving the problem. We have to get government out of our churches. We have to get government out of our schools. We have to get government back into compliance with the constitutions. With that, I think I've ranted enough, and let's just kind of move forward. We left off with some of Mr. Iredell's comments on impeachment, and this is a continued down through his lecture. Here's another highlight regarding the power of impeachment, and he says, "The power of impeachment is given by this Constitution to bring great offenders to punishment. It is calculated to bring them to punishment for crime, which is not easy to describe, which everyone must be convinced is a high crime and misdemeanor against the government. This power is lodged in those who represent the body of the people because the occasion for its exercise will arise from acts of great injury to the community, and the objects of it may be such as not can easily be reached by an ordinary tribunal. The trial before the Senate, least an inferior tribunal, should be too much awed by the powerful an accuser, such as the President of the United States. After the trial, thus solemnly conducted, it is not probable that it would happen once in 1,000 times that a man actually convicted would be entitled to mercy. And if the president has the power of pardoning in such cases, this great check upon high officers of state would lose much of its influence. It seems, therefore, proper that the general power of pardoning should be abridged in this particular instance. The punishment annexed to this conviction on impeachment can only be from removal from office and disqualification to hold any place of honor, trust, or profit." But you can't tell me that the presidents are not in positions of profit. And so that's why they should, past presidents are impeachable. "But the person convicted is further liable to a trial at common law and may receive such common law punishments as belongs to a description of such offenses. If it be punishable by that law, I hope for the reason I have stated that the whole of this cause will be approved by the committee. The regulations altogether, in my opinion, are wisely contrived as they could be. It is impossible for imperfect beings to form a perfect system." I want you to go to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the Red State Talk Radio podcast page, or where we list our shows, where you can come and download the show that you're listening to right now. At the very bottom of that page is a link to the records of Congress. In that document that is linked there, this actually gives you the timeline on page 13 of the PDF document. This gives you the timeline from Curry and Winterm, the MSNBC reporters who connected the dots of Clinton receiving money from China as he was giving them national secrets and access. There is no doubt about it. Is it Russia, Russia, Russia? You know, the Ukrainian mystery phone call? Are you kidding me? Congress needs to go after the Clintons and remove them I would actually like to see that direct descendants, not necessarily generations, but at least the direct descendant, the immediate family of a convicted treasonous person, should not be able to ever hold public office of any type. Why? Just because we understand that families tend to breed corruption. Especially when you see husband and wife do it, one might easily make a leap of faith that daughter be doing it too. And so, anyway, I'm done. I'm not grinding necessarily an axe, but I do want to impress upon you, past presidents can be impeached because they are receiving profit and emoluments from the federal government. Anyway, Mr. Spencer now makes this comment. Mr. Chairman, I arise to declare my disapprobation of this likewise. Here is an essential article in our Constitution that the legislative, the executive, and the supreme judicial powers of government ought to be forever separate and distinct from each other. The Senate, in the proposed government of the United States, are possessed of the legislative authority in conjunction with the House of Representatives. I'll drop it there. We'll pick it back up with Mr. Spencer's comments as an anti-federalist right after these two promos. So please stay tuned, and we'll be right back after this. Thank you so much. Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in. And let's get on with the dialogue.
Okay. They are likewise possessed. This is, again, Mr. Spencer, and he's the anti-federalist that is speaking up against the Constitution. And he says, they are likewise possessed of the sole power of trying all impeachments, which, not being restrained to the officers of the United States, may be intended to include all officers of the several states in the Union. Now, this is days after this has been refuted. This argument was clearly made and actually clarified by Mr. McClain, stating that it was all connected to the United States government. They are likewise possessed of the sole power of trying impeachments which are not restrained to the officers of the United States, may be intended to include the officers of the several states of the Union. And by this clause, they possess the chief of the executive power. They are, in effect, to form treaties which are to be the law of the land. And they have obviously, in effect, the appointment of all officers of the United States. The president may nominate, but they have a negative upon his nomination till he has exhausted the number of those he wishes to be appointed. He will be obliged, finally, to acquiesce in the appointment of those whom the Senate shall nominate, or else no appointment will take place. Now, maybe in those days where they had limited people, but with millions and millions of people today, you can easily see how the offices would just literally go unmanned, where you would not have people that would be the secretaries of states and so forth, where the Senate could become an enemy to the president of the United States when you get ideologically divided, which is exactly why Trump still does not have all of his positions filled, because of the Senate. But not too many people are talking much about that. Anyway, I'm telling you, impeachment was a huge deal, and the behavior of politicians was a huge deal in North Carolina. Because here is Mr. Davey making comment. The learned gentleman on my right, Mr. Spencer, after saying that this was an enormous power and that blending the different branches of government was dangerous, said that such accumulated powers was inadmissible and contrary to the maxims of writers. It is true that the great Montesquieu and several other writers have laid it down as a maxim not to be departed from, that the legislative, executive, and judicial powers should be separated and distinct. But the idea that these gentlemen had in view has been misconceived or misrepresented. An absolute and complete separation is not meant by them. It is impossible to form a government upon those principles. Those states who had an absolute separation of these powers, their leading principle, have been obliged to depart from it. It is a principle, in fact, which it is not to be found in any of the state governments. In other words, the state governments possess those exact same combined powers. The government of New York, the executive and the judiciary, have negative similar to that of the president of the United States. This is a junction of all three powers and has been attended with the most happy effects. In this state and most others, the executive and judicial powers are dependent on the legislature. Has not the legislature of this state the power of appointing judges? Is not in the power? You got to understand, you just hear what he said, that in the North Carolina state, that the legislature had the power of appointing judges. Is it not in their power also to fix their compensation? What independence can there be in persons who are obligated to be the obsequious, this is an interesting one, to be flattering, submissive, fawning, compliant, and cringing for their office and salary? Are not our judges dependent on the legislature for every morsel they eat? It is not difficult to discern what effect this may have on human nature. The meaning of this maxim I take to be this, that the whole legislative, executive, and judicial powers should not be exclusively blended in any particular instance. The Senate try impeachments. This is their only judicial cognizance. As to the ordinary objects of the judiciary, such as the discussions of controversies, the trials of criminals, etc., the jury, or the judiciary, is specifically separate and distinct from the legislative and executive branches. The House of Lords in England have great judicial powers, yet this is not considered as a blemish in their constitution. Why? Because they have not the whole legislative power? Anyway, so they're actually delving into how Montesquieu and how others basically made comments, and they're talking about the federal government And they're arguing that, hey, they're creating a government that is contrary to this. And then here, Mr. Davey stands up and goes, well, every state has this exact same problem then. Is that what you're saying? Anyway, Mr. Iredell makes this comment. According to these principles, I suppose the only instances in which the president would be liable to impeachment would be where he had received a bribe or had acted from some corrupt motive or other. Acted, not talked, not thought, not, you know, made notion of, but acted. If the president had received a bribe without the privity of knowledge of the Senate from a foreign power and under the influence of that bribe had addressed enough with the Senate. Now, keep Bill Clinton in mind here. Right? Okay, I'm going to start this over. And again, keep Bill Clinton in mind. If the president had received a bribe without the privity or knowledge of the Senate from a foreign power and under the influence of that bribe had addressed enough with the Senate by artifices and misrepresentations to seduce their consent to a pernicious treaty, if it appeared afterwards that this was the case, would not the Senate be as competent to try him as any other persons whatsoever? And I want you to understand what the heck happened with Clinton. I mean, Clinton was providing China. He gave them Panama. He tried to give them American ports as well. He was making concessions. Why? So that he could get money for his re-election. All of this was occurring as he was preparing for his election and needed money to ensure, not that he just needed money to ensure his re-election, he had to get, if you remember, who was that curmudgeon small guy from Texas? Perot. He had to get Perot into the race against Dole just so that he could win. Because you got to remember, Clinton did not win by the popular vote. In other words, he didn't win with 50% of the popular vote. He won enough of the popular vote in states to actually seat him. But I am telling you, had we had the Electoral College function the way the Constitution dictated that the electors would elect, and they could not be obliged to pass their vote because the party and or the state could force them, Clinton would never have made the 270 Electoral College requirement. We would have had to have another election. Clinton would not have become president after Bush, and he would not have become president, you know, on his re-election either. And this is why he resorted to these corrupt and you know, treasonous behavior and tactics. Anyway, would they not exclaim against his villainy? Would they not feel particular resentment against him for being made the instrument of his treachery purpose? In this situation, if any objection could be made against the Senate as a proper tribunal, it would be more properly be made by the president himself, lest their resentment should operate too strongly, rather than by the public on the ground of a supposed partiality. The president must certainly be punishable for giving false information to the Senate. He is to regulate all intercourse with foreign powers. Here, they're defining the president's responsibility of foreign relations and so forth. He is to regulate all intercourse with foreign powers, and it is his duty to impart to the Senate every material intelligence he receives. If it should appear that he has not given them full information, but has concealed important intelligence, which he ought to have communicated, and by that means induced them to enter into measures injurious to their country, in which they would not have consented to, had the true state of things been disclosed to them, in this case, I ask whether upon an impeachment for a misdemeanor, would such an account, the Senate would probably favor him? With respect to impeachability of the Senate, that is a matter of doubt. there have been no instances of impeachment for legislative misdemeanors, and we shall find upon examination that the inconveniences resulting from such impeachments would be more than preponderate the advantages. There is no great honor in the world than being the representative of a free people. There is no trust on which the happiness of the people has a greater dependence. Yet, who ever heard of impeaching a member of the legislature for any legislative misconduct? It would be a great check upon the public business if a member of the assembly was liable to punishment for such his conduct as such. And so anyway, we will get back to his comments here. They go on and on, but I do believe Mr. Iredell really resonates very well. We'll be right back after these two promos back into Mr. Iredell's comments. Thank you so much. Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcasts and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
Okay, so we were just getting into more details on the impeachment for Mr. Iredell, and he goes on and he continues to say, "Unfortunately, it is the case, not only in other countries, but even in this, that division and differences in opinion will contrarily arise. On many occasions, there will be two or more parties. These often judge with little clarity of each other and attribute every opposition to their own system of ill motive." Isn't this fascinating? "We know this very well from experience. Belt, in my opinion, this constant suspicion is frequently unjust. I believe in general both parties really think themselves right and that the majority of each commonly act with equal innocence of intention. But with the unusual want of charity in these cases, how dangerous would it be to make a member of the legislature liable to impeachment? A mere difference of opinion might be interpreted by the malignity of party into deliberate wicked action. It therefore appears to me at least very doubtful whether it would be proper to render the Senate impeachable at all, especially as in the branches of executive government where their concurrence is required, the president is the primary agent and plainly responsible, and they, in fact, are but a counsel to validate proper or restrain improper conduct of him. But if a senator is impeachable, it could be for corruption or some other wicked motive, in which case, surely those senators who have had from upright motives would be competent to try him. Suppose there had been such a council as was proposed, consisting of 13, one from each state, to assist the president in making treaties and etc., more general alarm would have been excited and stronger opposition made in this Constitution than even at present. The power of the president would have appeared to be formidable, and the states would have lost one half of their security. And since, instead of two representatives, which each has now for those purposes, they would have but one. A gentleman from New Hanover has asked whether it is not a practice in Britain to submit treaties to Parliament before they are esteemed as valid. The king has the sole authority by the laws of that country to make treaties. After treaties are made, they are frequently discussed in the two houses, where of late the most important measures of government have been narrowly examined. It is usual to move for an address of approbation, and has been the compliance of Parliament for a long time that this seldom hath been withheld. Sometimes they have passed an act in conformity to the treaty, but this is believed is not for the mere purpose of confirmation, but to make alterations in particular systems which the change of circumstances requires. The constitutional power of making treaties is vested in the Crown, and the power with whom a treaty is made considers it as binding. Without an act of Parliament, unless an alteration by such is provided for in the treaty itself, which I believe is sometimes the case. When the Treaty of Peace is made in 1763, it contains stipulations for the surrender of some islands to the French. The islands were given up, I believe, without any act of Parliament. The power of making treaties is very important and must be vested somewhere. In order to counteract the dangerous designs of other countries and to be able to terminate war when it has begun. I want to clarify something. In law, with fiduciary responsibilities and contract law and so forth and so on, in law, you only have the abilities to make a compact or to make a treaty with another party if you have the authority over those things that you are putting on the table. So in other words, let's say we have the Department of Agriculture that has been unconstitutionally usurped, and the government has basically said, we will buy and hold silage, and we will use this food supply, and we also have energy piles, you know, in other words, huge tanks of oil that are our reserves, national reserves, which are unconstitutional that we have these things. And so we find that the federal government now has the ability to create a treaty to give something that they have no constitutional power to give to another country, and or to use as an economic warfare tactic. Because, and I'm pointing this out, because if you look at why the Arab Spring occurred, we deliberately suppress the inflation of food with Bush as president, which created the scenario that once Obama became president, the Arab Spring rose, because all of a sudden the cost of food shot up because America was no longer dumping its silage into the market space. This was economic warfare that was conducted by Bush, and it was executed under Obama's watch, that caused this Arab Spring and this revolt around the world, or at least throughout the Middle East. My point is that all of this was being done, and whether it be done in a treaty or outside of a treaty, when you do things that you have no authority to do, then what you are doing is not legally binding. It's like me as just Joe off the street going in and saying, I'm going to sign some contracts for General Motors to basically, you know, give the Cadillac division over to Toyota. Well, I'm going to sign that. It's got to be a legit. We go, no, I don't have the authority to do it. It's the same thing with Congress, same thing with the president. If they have no jurisdiction over it, they cannot give you or give away our rights. And I want to put this in context to guns now. When the UN created a law and we signed this law, when the federal government has no ability to restrict the making of guns, the selling of guns, and the possessing of guns, but going into a treaty with the UN, that becomes the law of the land. No, they don't have the jurisdiction over that. They're restrained from making any laws that infringe our rights. So they violated the Constitution in trying to create that treaty. In essence, these are impeachable offenses. When the Senate signs off on these things, the president signs off, when they try to bypass and backdoor our Constitution, that is tantamount to rebellious behavior of the Constitution, and it's called treason and or at least sedition and moral perjury, and they must be removed. That's why this stuff is so important. Anyway, Mr. Iredell goes on and says, were it known that our government was weak, two or more European powers might combine against us. Would it be not politic to have some power in this country to obviate this danger by a treaty? If this power was judicially limited, the nations where the power was possessed without restriction would have greatly the advantage of us in negotiation. And everyone must know, according to modern policy, that what monument an advantage in negotiation is. The honorable member from Anson said that the accumulation of all the different branches of power in the Senate would be dangerous. The experience of countries shows that this fear is without foundation. What is the Senate of Great Britain opposed to the House of Commons? In other words, the House of Lords is equal to the Senate, when it really isn't. Anyway, although it be composed of a hereditary nobility of vast fortunes and entirely independent people, their weight is far inferior to that of the commons. Here is a strong instance of the accumulation of powers of the different branches of government without producing any inconvenience. That Senate, sir, is a separate branch of the legislature, the great constitutional council of the crown, and decides on lives and fortunes and impeachments. Besides being the ultimate tribunal for trying controversies respecting private rights, would it not appear that all these things should render them more formidable than the other house? Yet the commons have greatly been able to carry everything before them. The circumstance of representing the great body of the people alone gives them great weight. This weight has great authority added to it. By their possessing the right, a right given to the people's representatives in Congress, of exclusively originating money bills, the authority to money will do everything. In other words, the Senate can't write any bills regarding money. A government cannot be supported without money. Our representatives may at any time compel, and you see the Senate getting involved in money all the time now. They have blurred the line so much it just infuriates me. At any time to compel the Senate to agree to a reasonable measure by withholding supplies till the measure is consented to. There is a great debate in this convention whether the Senate should have equal power of originating money bills. And so anyway, we'll leave it off there because this is very insightful to how the Constitution operates in the separations of the Senate and the House. So we'll be right back after these two promos. So please stay tuned.
folks. Red State Talk Radio has brought back its monthly newsletter. I know everyone gets a lot of emails, but this is not a daily or weekly newsletter. It's a monthly newsletter. So you will not be overwhelmed with a plethora of emails from Red State Talk Radio. Come on, it's only once a month. I'll be contributing a constitutional perspective to one of the current issues to help everyone see an alternative perspective, or what I believe would be a framer's perspective regarding the issue, to help us maintain a constitutional paradigm. I will also provide information regarding a significant historical context to the time of year so that we can remember our history, so we will not be doomed to repeat the inevitable failings from forgetting our past and origins. Just go to Red State Talk Radio and sign up for the newsletter. This way you can get a focused view of what is going on in the Republic, as well as what is going on at Red State Talk Radio. Thank you.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.
Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255.
Okay, so moving on, and we're wrapping up this. I know this is kind of a long discussion, but it's not just about impeachments. This is about the separations of power and the purpose of why the Senate does this and why the House does this, and breaking it down in comparison and contrast to Parliament, the government that they just left. Anyway, Mr. Iredell goes on and says this: "It was strongly insisted by some that they should, but at length of a majority thought it inadvisable, and the clause was passed as it stands now. I have reason to believe that our representatives had a great share in establishing this excellent regulation, and in my opinion, they deserve the public thanks for it. It has been objected that this power must necessarily injure the people, inasmuch as a bate majority of the Senate might alone be assembled, and 8 would be sufficient for discussion or for decision. This is on a supposition that many of the senators would neglect attending. It is to be hoped that the gentlemen who will be honored with seats in Congress will faithfully execute their trust as well in attending as every part of their duty. An objection of this sort will go against all government whatever. Possible abuse and neglect of attendance are objections which may be urged against any government which the wisdom of man is able to construct. When it is known of how much importance attendance is, no senator would dare to incur the universal resentment of his fellow citizens by grossly absenting himself from his duty. Do gentlemen mean that it ought to have been provided by the Constitution that the whole body should attend before particular business was done? Then it would be in the power of a few men, by neglecting to attend, to obstruct the public business and possibly bring the destruction of their country. If this power be improperly vested, it is incumbent upon gentlemen to tell us in which body it could be more safely and properly lodged." You know, there are reasons why, and we've actually seen in Oregon where the state legislatures, enough of them left, and this happened in Texas. They went to Oklahoma, or maybe Oklahoma went to Texas, I forget. But this happens where the political divide, where the Democrats are trying to do such bad things that they can't get their two-thirds quorum or whatever the quorum requirements are, that the only recourse that the opposition has, instead of allowing them to ram bad legislation down our throat, is just literally leave attendance and say, you can't do this business without us. And if you're not going to consider our concerns, then we're not going to give you the privilege of ramming that down our people's throats. There are reasons why we have laid out the governments that we have, and there are reasons why the states have emulated these designs, because I just have to point, my friends, to the divine nature of the design. There are so many protections that are worth pointing out. But anyway, let's get to the next one. This is Mr. Spate, and this is what he says. He says, Mr. Chairman, the gentleman insinuates that differences existed in the Federal Convention respecting the clauses which he objects to. Whoever told him so was wrong, for I declare that in that convention the unanimous desire was to keep separate and distinct the objects of jurisdiction of the federal from that of the state judiciary. I want you to hear what he just said. Whoever told him so was wrong, that there are these unlimited jurisdictions of the federal government. I declare that in that convention, the unanimous desire of all was to keep separate and distinct the objects of jurisdiction of the federal from the state judiciary. In other words, the federal judiciary is tied to the enumerated powers. The state judiciary is tied to the state's enumerated and or ambiguous powers, because if it's not within the federal judicial system, then it is going to be within the state system. But when you deal with things that the federal government is doing that they have no judicial authority, nor would the states be able to actually decide that, this is why we have to exercise republic review to get the states together as the ultimate authority over the Constitution and make the necessary decisions in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution. That's why I say this all the time. Anyway, he goes on, Mr. Spate, and says, they wished to separate them as judiciously as possible and to consult the ease and convenience of the people. The gentleman objects to the cognizance of all cases in equity arising under the Constitution of the laws of the United States. This objection is very astonishing. When any government is established, it ought to have the power to enforce its laws, or else it would, might as well have no power. But what is the use of the judiciary? The gentleman has his profession, must know that no government can exist without judiciary to enforce its laws by distinguishing the obedient from the rest of the people, or the disobedient from the rest of the people, and imposing sanctions for securing the execution of the laws. As to the inconvenience of distant attendance, Congress has power of establishing inferior tribunals in each state so as to accommodate every citizen. As Congress have it in their power, they will not do it. Or are we to elect men who wantonly and unnecessarily betray us? Well, the answer to that question, Mr. Spate, is that yes, we have been answering, or I should say we've been electing people that have been seeking to betray us and deceive us. Now, this next note is also a note by Mr. Spate, or actually, no, this is Mr. McLean, and he says this. The gentleman has wandered out of his way to tell us what has so often been said out of doors, that there is no declaration of rights, that consequently all our rights are taken away. It would be very extraordinary to have a Bill of Rights because the power of Congress are expressly defined, and the very definition of them is as valid as efficacy a check of a Bill of Rights could be. without the dangerous implication of a Bill of Rights. The powers of Congress are limited and enumerated. We say we have given them those powers, but we do not say we have given them more. We retain all those rights which we have not given to the general government. The gentleman is a professional man. If a gentleman has made his last will and testament and devised to bequeath to a particular person the sixth part of his property or another particular specific legacy, could it have been said that the person should have the whole estate? If they can assume powers not enumerated, there was no occasion for enumerating powers. The gentleman is learned without recurring to his learning. He may only appeal to his common sense. It will inform him that if had all powers before and given but a part, we still retain the rest. It is as plain as things as possibly can be that Congress can have no power, but we expressly give it them. I want you to hear that. Congress can have no power except we expressly give it them or give them. Friends, unless we actually delegate to them per an amendment, and that is the only constitutional process that they can exercise any new power, they have no jurisdiction and no power over these things. There is an express clause which, however disingenuously, has been perverted from its true meaning, clearly demonstrates that they are confined to those powers which are given them. This clause enables them to, quote, make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into the execution of the foregoing powers and all other powers vested in this Constitution in the government of the United States or any department or officers thereof, close quote. This clause specifies that they shall make laws to carry into execution all the powers vested by this Constitution. Consequently, they can make no laws to execute any other power, like health care, like a retirement program of Social Security, like energy, like agriculture, like labor. This clause gives them no new power, but declares that those already given are to be executed by proper laws. I hope this will satisfy the gentleman. Clearly, and this is just one of the many that really lays out the argument with the 1-2 knockout punch that states that the federal government has enumerated powers and those are the only powers that they possess. We didn't need a Bill of Rights. The whole point in these debates is defining the fact that these are enumerated constitutions and a Bill of Rights is only applicable and only necessary when general powers are bestowed upon government. General powers being unlimited powers, and this is tantamount to the power of attorney, which we will be getting into probably in our next episode with Mr. Iredell, pointing to the concept of power of attorney generals and enumerated. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.